May it please the Court, Albert Chow on behalf of the petitioner, Li Changcheng. Your Honors, in this case, this is an asylum case, and as with most asylum cases, the issue here is credibility. We believe that in this case, though, the adverse credibility finding by the board and the immigration judge was based upon cherry-picking certain facts that bolstered their adverse credibility finding while ignoring certain facts that undermined that result. We also believe that in this case, the immigration judge was not an impartial adjudicator when she directed the government to introduce evidence in the middle of testimony to bolster their evidence once it was found that their evidence was insufficient and deficient. As an example of cherry-picking, the board stated that the father's letter indicated that when police came to question him about his son's whereabouts, he stated that he went out for work, and the board said, well, this supports the fact that the respondent or the petitioner came here for work, ignoring that the rest of the father's letter indicated that he had suffered persecution based upon his religion, and just a few sentences earlier stated that he escaped because he wanted more freedom.
Could you address some of the other inconsistencies? I thought the father's letter was very ambiguous, but there were other things like the distinction of when and how he had gotten from China to the United States.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe that the reason why they found him found inconsistency there was because of a previous statement that he had made at the border on the I-213. And that is exactly what I was talking about when I said that I believe that that particular document was deficient because it didn't state what language that the interview was conducted in. And not only that,
so did you challenge or did he challenge in the prior hearings that some of the information was inaccurate, that he had not understood it, or what was the basis for his claim? I mean, it was very detailed information that he had gone through Holland, Peru, Guatemala, and Mexico. So it wasn't like a word that was wrong or whatever.
No, it was the date, because on the I-213, he originally stated that he left China, I believe he said in January of 2016, where he testified that he actually left China much earlier in 2015. So that was where the inconsistency was. And what I'm saying is...
Well, I thought he said told the Border Patrol that he had departed China in 2006 and then went through France and Mexico, but on his asylum application, he had the Holland, Peru, Guatemala, and Mexico.
Yes, and that's what I was saying is that I was saying it, you know, and that's why I quoted Singh v. Gonzalez, stating essentially that documents such as these, which are short, conclusory, summary statements, should not be used for an adverse credibility finding because we don't, it's not a question and an answer. We don't know what question was asked, what the answer was given. This is an officer's recitation of what he believes that the petitioner stated, not exactly what he stated.
But the officer also said that if he had stated that, it would have been in the form.
Yes, but...
And so he was questioned on that very issue, and why isn't the immigration judge permitted to credit that testimony?
No, the immigration judge can credit that testimony, but what I'm saying is that these types of statements, and that's why I said in Singh v. Gonzalez, should not be used to support an adverse credibility finding because it's not a transcript. We're not sure exactly what the context was of the questions that were asked. Were there any follow-up questions? And perhaps did he misunderstand the question or did he misspeak? Like, for example, on page 320, when we're looking at the actual data, it says, subject admitted that he entered the U.S. illegally on about January 11, 2006, at approximately 60 hours by wading across the Rio Grande, approximately 2 miles east of Hidalgo, Texas, port of entry, a place not designated as a port of entry. I don't believe that the petitioner said all those things. That's a recitation of certain facts that the officer believed to be true. So what I'm saying is, in this type of interview, we're not sure exactly what he said and what context these answers were given. He may have just been mistaken. We don't know. And that's why I cited this particular case. Because in this case, the officer is not giving us a Q&A.
He was given the opportunity to provide further evidence and declined. Isn't that correct?
Well, Your Honor, no, he was not. In Ren v. Holder that I cited, as well as the G v. Holder, A petitioner must be given notice and opportunity to corroborate his claim. There was no notice given by the immigration judge in this case that he must submit certain evidence to corroborate when
he was charged. It's not a question of must submitting, right? It's his burden of proof to carry. And so the BIA said that he had time because there were several continuances and he had been questioned. So he was questioned in March about his travel to the United States. And then there was the proceedings were continued until July 31st to let the Border Patrol agent testify. And so the BIA notes, well, he had time to provide the information, but I think he said, no, the smugglers took all my information and the IJ didn't credit it, which was certainly within its purview to do.
Yes, but he was still not given notice. There was never any notice given that, hey, this is something that I need.
And well, the IJ doesn't have an obligation to say, this is something that I need. He was aware that there was an inconsistency because the IJ had pointed that out in March.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that there is. In the case that I cited, G.V. Holder, 751 F3rd 1088, 9th Circuit 2014, it says that notice of corroboration must be given for if the IJ refers in her decision to the lack of corroboration for that particular fact.
And that gives the notice, right?
I'm sorry?
That gives the notice, right, that there's a lack of corroboration.
Well, I would also submit to you, Your Honor, that his travels from China to the United States are completely collateral to the actual claim itself. What we're talking about...
Does that matter under the Real ID Act?
I believe it does matter in the sense that it is something that I believe that would be considered minor, simply because it doesn't have anything to do with whether or not he actually suffered the persecution that he's stating that he suffered.
Because Congress expressly overruled our going to the heart of the asylum claim jurisprudence.
Yes, that's true. And if there's a lack of corroboration for that, and if there's a slight inconsistency on that, that's only one minor inconsistency.
Well, there was also the IJ was concerned about inconsistencies in the timeline. When he graduated and when he was working at the beer company and went through the timeline as well. And since that related specifically to how he was introduced to Christianity, the IJA and the BIA thought that was fairly central.
Yes, Your Honor, and there was corroboration of of his employment. There was a letter from a coworker stating where it says, he was transferred from the head company to the Chiang Mai branch in 2001.
But that didn't correspond with the timeline that he had given, right?
It doesn't exactly correspond because he stated that he started work there in 1999. But It does state that he was transferred from the head company in 2001, which necessarily means that he worked for the head company before 2001, even though he didn't state exactly when he started work.
I thought he said that in 1999 he stopped at the beer factory and moved to selling vehicles at another company.
Right, and that was the company, the trading company, in which the letter referred to. That was the company that he was talking about.
It was a beer company in 1999, and the head company of the beer company sold vehicles? Am I understanding that correctly?
No, it's that he worked for a beer factory, and then he found a new job in 1999 for, I guess it was called a trading company, I believe, in the letter.
Uh-huh.
And then in 2001, he was transferred from the head company to a smaller branch. And so what I'm saying is his testimony that he started work there in 1999, while not exactly corroborated by that letter.
Because the IJ said, according to the registry, it showed that he was in elementary school at that time.
Yes, and that was, that's correct, and that's a minor consistency on his education because he did state that he had a junior high education. But again, there's no evidence that he had any standing to correct a household registry. His father is the head of the household. He's just the son. There's no evidence at all that he could have gone in there and corrected that if there was a mistake on his education. I see I have 28 seconds left, so I'll save that for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jesse Lorenz, and I represent the Attorney General of the United States in this matter. This court should decline to disturb the board's decision because record evidence fails to compel the conclusion that Mr. Chang presented a credible claim. I'd like to start by addressing a couple of things that were brought up by petitioner in his argument. In particular, his challenges to the forms, the I-213 and the I-826 in particular, are unfounded because DHS called the preparer of that form for testimony. He was subject to cross-examination, and he explained how the form was prepared, what kind of translation service was used. In particular, he testified that at that time they were using a translation service they'd call in when they needed a certain language translated. So any concerns with that form have been cured by the testimony of the Customs and Border Patrol agent.
I'm sorry, why is that the case?
Well, our argument, first of all, would be that there really is no need. The I-213 is reliable evidence, so there really is no need to have the agent testify. But because he did testify, we can be assured that of the way it was prepared, the manner in which it was prepared, how the information was entered. So his concerns about, you know, the information being entered incorrectly are cured by the fact that this agent testified and said, you know, this is how I did these things. This is what he would have told me. I wrote these down in my notes. I kept all the files separate, and then I put it into the form after the fact.
I'm sorry, he came up with notes?
He did not submit his notes, but he said that the agent said that he kept his notes at the time of creating this document and then would have put it into the form after the fact.
He didn't present the notes of the hearing?
The notes, he did not, what was presented before the immigration judge was the form I-213, the record of deportable alien.
And did he testify that he remembered the interview?
He did admit that he did not remember the interview at the time because they were processing apparently four or five people per day at that point, or each officer was required to process that many. But he did say that he...
So I'm not sure what his testimony adds. I mean, he can say, this is sort of my procedure, this is what I normally did. He couldn't even say for sure that he followed the procedure in this case, right?
Well, he did testify that, well, I suppose that's a fair point, Your Honor, but he did testify
It's just a question about the record. He doesn't say, I've looked at my notes before I came into court and they matched the form, right? He didn't say that.
He didn't say that, no.
Okay, he didn't say, I remember the interview and I remember that this is what he said.
He did not say that, no.
So he can't really say anything about it except that this looks like the kind of thing I do every day. And this is a procedure I normally follow.
Yes, that's true.
Right. So basically, that's as good as having a form.
Well, it lends a little more credence to the form. That's the government's position, at least. But that's also our position that his testimony wasn't required. The form on itself is reliable.
Well, how does it help him any? These discrepancies on that form, they don't make his asylum claim better or worse.
Well, actually, Your Honor,
whichever version you take,
I think they do. I mean, if you consider that the only the major incident of harm occurred in May 2004, and he's saying he leaves either according to the statement he said before the IJ or the statement before the Customs and Border Patrol agent, he either leaves in April 2005 or January 2006. Now that's a big time difference, and as part of this court's law is that basically the longer you stay in the country after the incident of harm, the less well-founded your fear of future persecution is. So that is a big difference. And also, there are a couple of things that may or may not have happened during that period of time. I mean, basically because of the inconsistencies, we don't know what happened between April 2005 and January 2006. According to his father's letter, you know, he leaves in April 2005. And then the police visit twice after that. But maybe he's there, maybe he's not. We don't really know because of this. So I think it does make a huge difference. Also, under the Real ID Act, the agency doesn't have to find inconsistencies that go to the heart of the matter. And here, I mean, we're talking about vastly different stories. I mean, basically...
Well, I understand the Real ID Act, but there's a difference between saying a matter, something doesn't go to the heart of the matter, and saying this is something that it makes a difference at all. I mean, could you know, people might remember a birth date wrong.
Well,
it may be discrepancy, but it may be, if the discrepancy doesn't sort of advantage the claim somehow, then it's less likely that this was a lie. It's more likely that it was a misunderstanding, maybe a misunderstanding on the part of the petitioner, or perhaps, you know, the officer who wrote it down wrong.
Well, I think it does advantage his claim because he has a letter from his father saying he left in April 2005. If he doesn't testify that he left in April 2005, then his testimony is necessarily inconsistent with his father's letter. And as I said, the longer he stays in China, the less, you know, the lower his well-founded fear is. It weakens his claim if he's in China for an additional 10 months. Also,
but you mentioned that in that period, the police came around twice, right?
Well, so his father's letter claims that after he left China, the police came by.
After he petitioned and left China.
Yeah, well, according to his testimony, but not according to what he said to the Customs and Border Patrol agent. But according to his testimony, his testimony and his father's letter, he left China in April 2005, and then the police came to his father's house twice after that. I mean, and that's his way of showing continued interest in him. But if he's still in China during that period of time, that is slightly undercut. And then, as I said, the longer he remains in the country following the major incident of harm, the less likely, the lower his well-founded fear is. Also, we have to keep in consideration, when he told CBP that he had left China in January 2006 and arrived in January 2006, that was contemporaneous to when that happened. He's testifying, you know, several years later before the immigration judge, and at that point he needs to cure his testimony with his father's letter. So we don't really have any incentive for him to lie to Customs and Border, but then there is an incentive to lie to the immigration judge. Or I shouldn't say lie, but, you know, conform his testimony with the evidence that he submitted.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that there shouldn't be great reliance placed on the household registration document?
Well, I would disagree with that because it is a government record that he has submitted in support of his claim. And basically the record on the bottom of it says that it was renewed or refreshed or whatever in April of 2000. So that's pretty specific that they redid the household registry in April of 2000 or renewed it or it was refiled or something of that nature. And it still listed him as an elementary school student. Now,
He was 15 at the time.
He's 15 at the at that time I believe he would have been 17 or 18. But it's a government record that he has presented as truthful. I mean, he's presenting it in support of his own claim, and it does interfere with his claim that he was graduated by that point in time and had at that point in time worked at two different jobs. I mean, it doesn't say anything about those jobs, and he's on his second job at that point according to his own claim.
But you've had enough experience to know that those household registries are often used by the folks in China for purposes other than the ones we're talking about today.
Well, I can't really speak to those, but in this case, I mean, it is inconsistent with his claim that he's been graduated and working for.
But his father prepared that, and who knows what the motivation or how much care was actually taken to verify or conform that to the realities at the time.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know in this case. I don't have any access to that information, what happened, what his father did, what his father did not do.
All the more reason not to rely on that document.
Well, but he submitted it in support of his own claim, and it is important to remember that it's his burden of proof, and we're talking about a totality of the circumstances test. This is one more thing that kind of goes into all the totality of the inconsistencies.
I'm trying to understand the inconsistency. The form was submitted in 2004, right?
The form
In 2000, right?
The form was prepared or made in 2000, according to the form itself. When it was submitted was later on during the proceedings, sometime probably in 2012.
And at that point, he would have completed elementary school, right?
I would imagine so, Your Honor, but I mean, I can't really speak to that.
Well, I'm not sure I understand what the inconsistency is.
Well, Your Honor, the inconsistency is that he's saying that he graduated middle school in July 1998 and has worked at two jobs since July 1998, once at a beer factory until June 1999.
One of which was illegal, right?
The
one job was illegal because he was too young.
I don't know anything about Chinese labor law, so I'm not really sure. But the inconsistency is that he's presenting documents that...
I thought he testified to that effect.
That he worked as...
That it was illegal, that he was 15 and he was not allowed to...
I don't remember that from the record, that it was an illegal job. I think he said he graduated from middle school and then started working at a beer factory.
But that's all I recollect from that. Whether it was illegal or not really doesn't go to his claim anyways, because he's, like I
said...
Well,
it explains why they might not have disclosed if the booking was illegal, it explains why it might not be on the form.
I could be incorrect, Your Honor, but I don't remember that being part of the record. I don't remember him claiming that his work at the beer factory was illegal.
The IJ, I think, expressed skepticism that he would have been 15 and working at a beer factory.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did he respond to that?
Not really, and maybe that's where Judge Kaczynski's concern comes in. But the IJ did express concern and thought that it was implausible that he'd be working at the beer factory at that time. But I don't remember that being explored in great length. Only that, you know, his testimony that he was working was inconsistent with his household registry and the immigration judge's belief that he shouldn't be working there at the time. Your Honors, I can see that I'm over my time. If I may summarize, please.
I think you're done.
I'm sorry.
I think you're done.
I'm done? No more time? Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
I mean, you are some time, but we'll forgive it.
Oh, okay. Can I...
We won't take it out of your next case.
Okay, thank you. Without credible evidence, there are major shortcomings...
You're done.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were allowing me to summarize. My apologies.
No, I was promising not to take time you owe us out of your next case.
All right.
Your Honor, just as a point, the I-213 ad on itself was deficient. It did not contain the language that was used during the interview. It was only when the IJ directed government counsel to submit the I-826 that we found out what language was used, and that was impermissible by the judge. She overstepped her bounds by essentially directing government counsel to file documentation to support deficient evidence.
Well, why is that overstepping the bounds? Is there have we so held, or?
Under 8 CFR 1003.10, the IJ shall administer oaths, receive evidence, interrogate, examine, and cross-examine witnesses. Nowhere does it say that an IJ can submit evidence.
So that's your position, is
yes.
That the request? Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Okay, case is argued. We'll stand submitted.